Welcome back to Campaign Monsters. This is a podcast where we talk about monsters.
Thanks, buddy. Today I'm joined by BJ Martino. Or is it Martino? Maybe I should have asked him that. Of the GOP polling firm Terrence Group. In this episode, we dive deep into the status of polling and what the future of the industry looks like beyond 2024.
BJ, how's it going, man?
It's going great. How are you?
Good, good. It's good hanging out with you the other day in a colder state, and looks like we're going to be working a lot together this cycle.
I hope to get back to the Midwest more when it's not like single digits or negative digits out. It seems I'm only in, and I do a lot in the upper Midwest, and they never invite me out in June and July when it's pleasant. I'm only there in January and February when it's, you know, miserable. But I'm from Cleveland originally, so it's kind of like going home.
Gotcha. Well, you and I went out to dinner with the rest of campaign. It's about to launch. We're not going to say who yet, but this will come on. This will debut after that launch. But anyway, you and I were in a state where it was negative 12 degrees whenever we headed out for dinner and beer. So it is now 75 here in South Carolina, a little more comfortable today. But man, how did you, tell me about your career. Like, how did this happen for you? You're pollster at one of the most prestigious firms on the Republican side. Like, how did that happen?
Well, it started off when I was going to school at, I went to Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm from, a degree in economics and minor in poli sci. And I was volunteering on campaigns, but really caught the bug while I was there. And it was as much as what I was doing as who I was learning from. There was a great professor, Alec Lamus, who wrote a couple great books on Southern politics that I actually would go back to and reread chapters on some of the states about the development of the two-party South. And he was very much focused on campaigns. All of his work is about winning elections. And so, and we also were completely diametrically opposed politically. He considered himself a Huey Long Democrat. But we had a great rapport, and I really learned to love the study of campaigns. And with my degree in economics, I thought, well, then polling and the data science aspect of it is really where I want to pursue. I moved out here to DC to get my master's degree at the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, one of the adjunct professors, Brian Tringali, who's now my partner, was looking for junior analysts and brought me on. And so that was 1998.
Wow.
When I started at the Terrence Group and started off answering the phones for my first few weeks, and have progressed slightly, have risen slightly in the ensuing year since then.
It's interesting that you knew on the front end that polling was your thing, because for a lot of us campaign hacks, we have to work on campaigns on the front end, right? And then it's like a few cycles until we gravitate towards something. But you like gravitated towards the numbers like right on, it sounds like.
Yeah, that was where I was studying the numbers from an economic perspective, and I was doing a bunch of work entering Bureau of Labor data, statistics data, and doing analysis of that. And then I realized there's all this other data that campaigns are producing, and election data and results that you can analyze on top of that. Even before we got to the days of, you know, voter files became as rich as they are today, there was a lot of data out there. And so that really captured my imagination, and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
That's awesome, man. Well, you started in 98, so you've seen dramatic changes in the landscape. And I want to talk to you a lot about that before we get into your campaign story. You know, first, we're hearing polling's been crapped on a lot in recent cycles, I guess is the best way to say it, right? And there's this narrative that's happened in the mainstream media that polling is just inaccurate. Now, we both know that a lot of that's because it's these national polls conducted by the media. They don't see the campaign polls, but why do you think that narrative's been created? And what's going on there?
Well, yeah, I like to say they've been crapping on campaign polls for the entire time I've been in the industry. I mean, you go back to the 2000 election cycle, there were stories about how the polls were inaccurate and don't pay attention to them. I liken it to Michael Corleone in Godfather 2, who said, you know, Hyman Roth's been dying of the same heart attack for 20 years. People have been saying polling's been dying for 20 years, and here we are still an essential part of campaigns. I think a lot of it is that there are so many polls out there nowadays, and there's a really low barrier to entry for public polling. You know, every university has a poll that's run by a professor of political science, and they use student interviewers. And it started off with like Quinnipiac, right? Who knew what a Quinnipiac was before they had a poll nationally? Yeah. All of a sudden, that raised the Q rating for that university, and they now it's a name that people recognize, not just basketball, but you know, but also but polling. And I think a lot of other universities saw that and said, why can't we replicate that? We can get our name in the news, in the local papers, if we start generating some of this polling data. And their methodologies don't tend to be as rigorous as some of those who do this professionally for a living are holding ourselves to, and the standards we hold ourselves to. And there's just so much of it. You see even natural margin of error stuff bounces back and forth on a lot of these public polls, and people don't get that, right? Then you throw in the fact that there are some bad actors on, I think, both sides of the aisle who inject polls into the narrative for the sake of helping to shape a narrative rather than trying to be accurate. And then finally, a lot of our polling is done for private interest, right? We're not doing a lot of polling that's released into the public domain, but everyone is judged on what public polls that are out there. And oftentimes they're polls that are released a month out, a month and a half out from election day. You know, there's a lot of water that goes under the bridge and many millions of dollars that are spent in that intervening time. And to be judged for a poll that you did in September for its accuracy in predicting election day, I don't think is appropriate.
Yeah.
Now, many of them and most of the polls we do are done earlier because you have pollsters who do polls for prescriptive reasons, like professionals like ourselves, meaning helping campaigns make decisions, prescribing what are the right messages, what are the right targets. Mm-hmm. But most of the public polling is done strictly for predictive, right? What's going to happen? That's all the media cares about in sort of their narratives. And so when you get judged on a poll that is designed to and timed to help a campaign make decisions earlier in the cycle and say, well, you weren't accurate. Your last poll, you know, had us down 3 and we only lost by a point. Well, yeah, but yeah, that happened 2 months ago. Certainly a lot has happened since then.
Well, that's a good point I never thought of, because when I talk to, say, my in-laws, for an example, who are big Fox News viewers and Newsmax viewers, they always come to me, well, you can't believe any poll. But I get a poll in my inbox every single day. At least once a day, a poll arrives in my inbox. Today, I got something from you with new data layered on some polling you did, and I spent 30 minutes reviewing your email this morning. And what I see in my inbox is not, or I should say what they see on the news is not reflective of what I see in my inbox. So I think you're right. You're comparing apples to oranges, where theirs is, and I never thought about this, designed strictly for prediction to write a news story. And ours are based on foundationally making strategy decisions. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have no one does a poll out of the kindness of their heart.
That's right.
The poll has a underlying reason. And for the media, for the most part, that reason is to get eyeballs or clicks or however you want to judge that to pay attention to them. And they actually like to have polls that show a lot of movement because that's sexy.
Yeah.
You know, to say, oh, a week ago it was down 3 and now it's a +1. That's interesting. It's boring when your professional pollster comes back and says, well, we spent $3 million and we moved the needle a point. You know, it's not a lot of movement. Yeah. It's within the margin of error. It's real, you know, what we're giving you in terms of our measurement. But the public polling doesn't like that. They don't want to report on that the numbers haven't changed last week. They'd love to report that, oh, Biden's job approval is the worst it's ever been. Or, You know, so many say that this candidate is too old and too decrepit to run. They love having changes because that's new. It's news, but it's not necessarily the most accurate.
So as the digital guy on the campaign, I have to deal with a changing industry almost every week. They, you know, whether it's a platform changing an algorithm or a new rule about AI, you know, it's always something with us. But you guys have had to obviously change your methodologies a ton also since you started 98, mostly because of cell phones, for example. So I'm in South Carolina. So as you can imagine, I'm getting a shit ton of polls right now. I got three this weekend. One was a phone poll, two were texting polls.
Right.
Is the texting, I'm eager to know more about this because it's not something I honestly know a whole lot about. So I want to be schooled a little bit. Do you do the texting side? Is that working? Is that been increasing responses? I mean, tell me the reasons for that occurrence.
I think there's a couple. First and foremost, they are generally more affordable than live interviewers. So you're going to find a lot of folks who use that. But I think they have some advantages. There's a segment of the electorate that will respond to a text message that they receive who aren't going to pick up the phone from a phone number they don't recognize 100%. On their cell phone. And so what allowing some text to web interviews into our methodology has allowed us to do is to improve the response from a segment of the electorate that we had a hard time. We'd have to dial more and more and more to reach, and they were getting increasingly, you know, harder to reach and more expensive to reach. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly given us that ability. We blended that in a couple cycles ago. I really started prior to that, before we started doing, and I had confidence in text to web interview collection, I would text my phone numbers before I dialed them and let them know that you're going to receive a call from this number on this night. It's a survey. Make your voice heard so that when someone saw that number come up on their phone, they knew, oh, they could say, oh, this was the text message about a survey. It's not a telemarketer trying to tell me my car's warranty is expired. And that actually improved our response rate.
Nice.
Now I feel more comfortable with blending live with text to web interviews. There's still some drawbacks. The primary one is that, you know, prior to this in a live call, someone would either have to write down all of your questions or maybe audio record the survey as it was being taken and feed that information to your opponent. Now it's as simple as screen capturing. So you have to be very careful about the questions you ask, but we've always been very careful about making sure everything we test is vetted fully and we have all the research on. Mm-hmm. But I remind campaigns that it is immediate now. I can be doing this interview with a respondent and it could be on Twitter or on social media screen from the interview while the interview is still going on. They could start live, tweeting the questions that we're throwing out.
And that's especially bad on message testing. I mean, like ballots, yes. One thing, because everybody's going to test ballot. They're going to test favorability, right? Wrong, right track, wrong track. Everybody's going to be, but message testing, I can really get you in trouble. And heck, one of the texts I got this weekend, I guess was from Nikki Haley asking what I thought about Donald Trump's mental capacity. So, immediately I'm screenshotting that and sending it over to friends on the Trump campaign.
Right. And so you have to be you have to walk into the survey accepting the premise that the other side is going to get this entire survey. And so it changes how you approach asking some questions. We've always been cautious about asking things that we thought were sensitive or we thought we had Oppo on, but maybe the other side didn't know we had that information yet. And do we want to test it in a survey of 400 people and tip our hand that we knew some piece of information? So we've always been cautious about that. But I think it makes us even more so. That said, I've gone through a couple cycles now of doing message testing in a mixed mode with live interviews and with text to web, and it's worked well. You just have to, as a campaign, understand that everything you test, you know it's going to go across to the other side. So word it in such a way, don't tip your hand on things you don't want to tip your hand on, and be ready to address some of those things. If you get a call from a reporter that night saying, hey, we think you're doing a poll and you're asking about your opponent, where's your evidence or your proof of this? So, hey, have all your ducks in a row.
So things have evolved a lot. They're going to continue to evolve. What's next, do you think? How do you foresee polling changing in the next, couple cycles?
Well, the challenge is going to continue to be data collection. And it's not just for the small data guys like myself, the pollsters. It's for the big data folks as well. I don't want to say they have it easier. They want to just consume vast quantities of data coming in. They usually only need a couple questions in order to build their models. I need to keep someone on the phone or on a screen for 15 minutes answering a longer questionnaire. So getting those people to answer, collecting that in a representative way of the electorate is going to continue to be the ongoing challenge. It's what's driven every sort of major innovation and change. You go back to my beginning, we didn't use voter lists back 20 some years ago because they were notoriously poorly maintained. They were better in some counties than others, and it would impact the quality of the sample you got back. So we would do random digit dial surveys in geographic areas. There weren't cell phones, and you knew if you had this phone string, you lived in this specific geographic area. And then cell phones came around, and a lot of the studies early on showed that early cell phone adopters, who are more young people, their political views matched the young people who still had landlines. And so the polling industry didn't feel any pressure right away to begin to adopt cell phones. And then all of a sudden, we started to see a separation where the younger voters with landlines who remained were more conservative, and the ones on the cell phones were more ideologically liberal. As a result, you couldn't just replace one for the other. It was screwing up internally the samples, making those young people look too conservative. So that pressure caused that change. Now the pressure of cost of live interviews to cell phones and the challenge of getting younger people to even answer a cell phone for a number they don't recognize is such that it's forcing this. So the future, I think, is by hook or by crook, get people to conduct interviews. And that might mean going through social media to recruit individuals. But it's always going to start with the voter list. It's always going to be looking across the voter list and trying to get that representative sample and say, all right, we know that these segments still respond to live calls, and there's still three people with landline phones, so let's make sure we call them, and let's text this segment. And then we have this other segment over here that they don't really respond anymore to texts, or they don't respond to calls. How do we go after them? Do we send them an invite through social media to participate? Do we have to incentivize them? I think there's a lot of questions. But I think most of the pollsters are just willing to right now in this coming cycle work with what we have, because I think we have a pretty good blend right now with the live and the text. And then there's the advent of AI that I think is beginning to impact some of what pollsters do, in that it'll certainly is used by a lot of pollsters, myself included. Sometimes you have a topic that someone wants to do a poll on an issue. You could ask an AI engine to come up with some questions. Help me brainstorm questions. AI's been great for that. AI's been great for helping us analyze unstructured content. So I ask a lot of closed-ended questions in surveys. Do you think things right direction, wrong track? But then we ask open-ended questions where we allow respondents to give us feedback verbatim. And AI's been useful for helping find emerging themes from a lot of unstructured data from 500, 600 respondents across the survey and do that quickly. The one thing I don't think AI is going to be particularly useful for is in actually conducting the interviews for us, because from a quantitative perspective, I need a consistent set of questions that I can then look across the entire data set on. AI might be good for more qualitative type interviews, a one-on-one or even a focus group where it can sort of lead a less structured conversation. But I don't see AI sort of replacing either a fixed survey someone takes online or a live caller interviewer that is leading someone through a questionnaire.
To your point about helping you brainstorm, I have ChatGPT open on my screen at all times just for brainstorming purposes. I just have a conversation with it all day. It's my outside brain. I got my inside brain and I analyze things, and I have my outside brain to help me think of things I hadn't thought of internally. So, you know, I'll write a 30-second script for a digital ad. I'll even write internal memos to my team, and I'll run it through ChatGPT first and say, you know, what do you think about this?
I was amazed at its ability to come up with questions. A lot of them, they're standard questions that I had already thought of. But then a few others like, oh, this is coming at this issue from a way I hadn't thought of before.
Exactly.
That gives me another idea that I can bring back and transform myself into a meaningful question. And the capacity to take, you know, to add a couple thousand words that 600 people have said in a single open-ended question, and in 30 seconds say, okay, three major themes emerged from all the things that people said in this response. Here they are. And we independently ourselves coded those responses to get a look. And that coding process from a human takes a couple hours to go through all those interviews and code them. And the AI did it in 3 seconds and did a very good job of it.
This is beautiful.
And in campaigns, the time is our only resource we can't get from, right? And so the ability to save a couple hours and be on the call with the campaign and give them our advice and recommendations, you know, doesn't mean we have to wait for all that hand processing to be done.
Oh, that's a great point. And one more question before we get into your story, because you brought it up shortly. You know, one of the texts I got this weekend, after 15 questions, I just stopped. And I'm a 45-year-old guy, so I'm getting up there in age. I've hit midlife, I guess. And I'm a professional politico, so I like taking these polls. And I had enough. I was like, that's enough. So I guess my point to my question actually is, with attention spans getting worse and worse and worse, I'm not even wanting to run 30-second ads now. I'm only wanting to run 15-second ads online. How are you able... I mean, if you can even get folks to answer the phone or to click on the text at all, how are you going to deal with this attention span issue? Because it's only getting worse.
First of all, it is not asking as long a questionnaire as we used to. I mean, the days, there aren't many 20-minute, 25-minute surveys as there were, because you just can't keep people on that long. But there are some things you can do. Having live interviewers does tend to help, because that person can, interviewer, besides asking the questions as read, can help engage that person, encourage them between questions, say, you're doing great, we're almost there. It is incumbent upon the pollster and those who are writing the questionnaires to write a questionnaire that you would want to take and is engaging.
Yeah.
They're not to. I look at especially some of the public polls where they hear, here's a laundry list of 30 issues. For each of them, tell me whether you think Trump or Biden would do a good job. And I think, you know, after the 20th one in that series, I just want to go jump out a window. And I do this for a living. And so it's, you know, making sure that every question we ask is not frivolous, because that's expense for the campaign. I always ask myself on any survey, is fielding the survey, are we going to spend money on the results? For every question, are we going to spend money on the results of this question, whether it comes back 30-70 or 70-30, is it going to change what we do? If not, we don't ask it, because it's just, I don't care to scratch intellectual itches. But then also, how do I look at this from the perspective of someone taking this? You know, the only one I know who still takes 25-minute long interviews is my mom, because, you know, she thinks it might be my company. And she's told me this. She's taken incredibly long surveys, and she said, well, I thought it might be you. Like, it's probably not me, Mom, and I would not be asking you to stay on the phone for 25 minutes or more.
Well, have you been doing this since 98 and before, right? So when you were in school, what's one of your favorite campaign stories?
I think my favorite goes back to the 2012 recall election of Scott Walker back in Wisconsin. We had helped Governor Walker. We did his polling in the 2010 election, and then he got into office. As you may remember, it seems like a million years ago, he passed Act 10, which was the big law that has stripped some of the collective bargaining out of the state employees unions. It helped fix the state's structural deficit. It gave all the school systems new tools to balance their budgets and not have to raise property taxes while maintaining the dollars they needed. huge, amazing change, which has paid huge dividends to the state to this day. But of course, triggered massive protests in 2011.
Oh, yeah. Was teachers
recalls? They launched recalls against some of the state senators, but they couldn't launch a recall against Walker due to state law because he had just been elected. They had to wait a year. So they started gathering petitions, and it at that point was the most interesting campaign that I'd been a part of because it was outside the norm of a November election, but it had the intensity of a special election on, you know, supercharged, right? And the fact that it allowed us to, it gave us the freedom. And I worked with a great team, starting from the GC, RJ Johnson and Keith Jilks and guys in Wisconsin that I've worked with for years, who really built a great collaborative model where we all trust each other. They trusted our data and we worked together to, I think, do some beginning of some novel things. You know, let me as the pollster, if I had ideas, if I had something else I wanted to take a look at because it was something was bothering me in the data, I was given the runway to go after that. You know, I wasn't spending $1 million on research, but I was allowed to dig into things that I thought were problematic. I mean, it, to the extent that my story about this is, as the recall date came up in June, they were calling for folks around the country who wanted to come help Walker do doors. And I had been polling statewide. I'd been polling for some of the state Senate candidates who were also being recalled. And for some reason, I couldn't figure out why Kenosha County was underperforming. And my polling, it wasn't where it should be. And it was bugging me. So I was going to volunteer. I wanted to do doors. And that was, I did doors in Wisconsin in 2002 in the snow when we first took back the state Senate. Because I wanted to go out there and I was going to do doors. So I called up and told them that I was coming to help Walker. They had a 1-800 line you could call to sign up to tell them you were coming. And I said, I'm coming, but I'm only going to go walk in Van Wangard's district in Kenosha County. And I said, whoever answered the phone, I threw for a loop because they walked up to John Schmieder, who was running the GOTV operation, and said, some lunatic from Virginia called and said he wants to go work in this one state Senate district. And Schmieder said, who is this person? And they said my name. And he's like, oh, that's fine. He can go do whatever he wants to do. So I ended up walking doors in Caledonia that day and was going back to the state Senate headquarters. And we realized that the reason why this district was such a pain was that Obama for America had been using Kenosha as a test market for some of their activities leading up to the 2012 presidential. And on the day of the recall, they had bussed up OFA and bussed up people from Chicago into Kenosha and were turning people out into the city of Kenosha. So that made sense that I realized why was Kenosha always underperforming is because of all the other statewide spending and things we saw, OFA was doing a bunch of stuff under the radar and was messing with Kenosha County in a different way that we weren't picking up and that I didn't pick up that it was them until actually the day of the
recall. But this is a beautiful story, man, because I love it because it's why all these different parts of a campaign have to communicate with each other. Because I just love the fact that your numbers were off and you went door to door to figure it out. Like, what pollster has ever done that before? I've never heard that shit in my life. Like, you just had to do whatever it took to get it done.
It bugged me. And I, you know, I wanted to get Senator Wengard across the line. And unfortunately, he did lose that race, although he came back. But it bugged me. And I just need to be on the ground and go, I need to go figure this out.
Well, first off, that's pretty damn obsessive. But in a really great way.
And it's a state, you know, I love that state. And again, it was one of my first big clients was doing the state Senate even 10 years before that. So spent a lot of time in the state and always come back to enjoy the cheese curds and the brats and the beer.
Well, I got a feeling you and I will be spending a lot of time in that state this year. And, you know, I guess my parting advice for the listeners here is hire a pollster who is willing to go door to door to figure out why his numbers are a bit off. That's the guy you want on your team. So, BJ,
I need to go back and do it. I realized it was 10 years. It was 2002. It was 2012. I didn't go back in 22. So I'm due. I'm overdue to come back this cycle and come do some doors again on election day. I just got to figure out where it's going to be. It was Tomah in 2002. And then it was Kenosha. So we'll see where in the state I am this November.
I tell you what, I'll make a deal with you because I got a feeling I'll be in that state in November. So I will go door to door with you.
Excellent. I'll let you borrow my lucky Wisconsin embroidered deer camouflage cap. Because when I came out in 2002 to do doors for the first time, the great Bob Seitz, who was running campaigns for the state Senate at the time, he took me out to Tomah to go do doors. And I did not look like I was from Wisconsin when I got there. So he pulled into a gas station and bought me a cheap cap that they says embroidered Wisconsin with a deer on it, camo cap. And so I wore that around for the day. And that's been my cap, my lucky cap ever since.
I love it.
We'll bust out the gas station caps and hit some doors.
Well, this particular client that we are working on together is constantly making fun of the way I dress. So I will turn to you for my advice.
Hey, don't come to me for sartorial fashion sense. That's not who you want to ask.
Oh, man. All right, brother. I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It was great.
Thank you for listening to Campaign War Stories. Please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get new episodes sent straight to your inbox by subscribing at wesleydonahue.com. I hope you have a phenomenal day full of positive vibes.